This is my second time on Earth, at least so it appears. I've knocked around in ether for years and years and years. I've been a ghost from time to time, and other things as well. But who and when and what I was, I'm blowed if I can tell. I'm one of the queens of England, and I can't remember which. I like wearing all the dresses, which made me very rich. I don't know who the hell I was, or what I might have been. But one thing is for certain, I was not the Virgin Queen. Hello, my dears. It is Douglas Bing here, and I can tell we're all going to get on very, very well. So there's no need to bother with my full title, the late Douglas Bing. Yes, don't be fooled by this too solid flesh. I'm really only here in spirit. I always hoped that one day I'd come back as a ghost. I had imagined myself haunting some second-hand bookshop for a dusty copy of my autobiography, reduced to just 50 pence, so I could relive all the fun I'd had. But isn't this so much nicer? Here, with all of you, in this sweet little theatre. Yes, this is the world I remember. The lights, the velvet curtains, a piano, and someone lovely to play it. Say hello to Martin, everybody. He wasn't my first choice. I suppose I had always been afraid of death, which is silly, really, because like birth, we all experience it sooner or later, and in my case, it was rather later, at the grand age of 94. I had a fabulous professional career spanning more than 70 years. So long, in fact, that an actor pal of mine once greeted me with the line, "Oh, hello, I thought we were both dead." My end finally came in 1987, but I always wanted people to remember me from a box in a theatre, not a box at a funeral. So I've come back tonight to do just that, to have another night of glamour, a gay party with my friends in a pretty place in Brighton, some drinks, some stories, some fun. Like the old days. I was born in Nottingham on the 17th of March, 1893, St. Patrick's Day, which may explain why my heart always skips a beat whenever I pass a building site. My mother was my father's second wife. I had one brother, Noel, and 10 grown-up step-brothers and sisters. We had several nice nursemaids, and I can still remember sitting on the nursery table before being put to bed while my nurse tied up my golden curls in pieces of rag, then having them brushed out the next morning on a shiny cylindrical black ruler to make me look like little Lord Fauntleroy. It was an age of middle-class Victorian respectability. My father was the managing director of the Midland Counties District Bank, and as head of the family, expected everybody to obey him. My mother was kind and sentimental, but inclined to be rather straight-laced. I remember a little girl came over for tea once, and she asked us all the conundrum, "Why did the lobster blush?" "Because it saw the crab undressed." She was never asked back. But that was the kind of humour that made me hoot. And over the following 70 years, my jokes became so saucy, it's a wonder I was allowed out anywhere at all. I hated Sundays most of all. We weren't allowed to play jolly tunes on the piano, card games, or anything that was not virtuous or instructive. The only joyous event was the afternoon parade on Mansfield Road, when the girls from the lace and hosiery factories, renowned as the prettiest in the Midlands, put on all their finery as if it were Gold Cup Day at Ascot. I have always loved to dress up. Even as a very young child, I remember once I caused quite a stir when, in order to play a Georgian dandy, I bathed myself in milk, added a wig made out of hemp matting, a purple overcoat and a tall cane, and then I swanked up the Mansfield Road as part of the Sunday parade. Like Beau Brummel. I waved and greeted imaginary fellow fops until I encountered some of my real neighbours and the illusion crumbled. I was suddenly little Douglas Bing again. Was my face red? Needless to say, it was, courtesy of Max Factor. My parents did throw lovely parties for guests and relations. They would all arrive in evening dress for a 9 or 10 course dinner, then play cards or the piano late into the night. At one of these parties, I was sat at the front of the room to listen to a very large lady with drawn-up hair, a bulging white satin dress and pince-nez perched precariously above her very prominent false teeth. She sang with great gusto, "Every morn I bring thee violets." But each time she opened her mouth for a long note, I had a worm's eye view of her dentures. The absurdity of her dress and the seriousness of her demeanour made me laugh and laugh until it disrupted the performance. I was rushed from the room by my mother and reprimanded severely for my insolence. But it had a profound impact upon me, for the chestnut bun hair, pince-nez and voluminous bust were to become my trademark in cabaret. I can only have been 7 or 8 when my brother Noel and I had some very dull children thrust upon us as tea-time guests. We turned the nursery into a café chantant with small tables and chairs and some artificial palms from the first-floor landing. We stripped to the waist with silk Union Jack handkerchiefs left over from Mafeking night celebrations tied around our heads and our lower halves draped in bath towels. We entertained our bewildered small guests with exotic oriental dances until the sudden appearance of our mother, who closed the show. Later, however, Mother made pretty costumes for me and my brother to perform our home entertainments in, and as a result, I developed an early interest in clothes. I would spend much of my spare time drawing and painting ladies' costumes for the theatre and love to watch visiting female friends of my parents and aunts putting on their long white gloves in the hallway and remembering the detail of what everyone wore. Theatres led the way in fashion in those days, so I was entranced when my mother took me to see Marie Studholme, one of the first Gaiety pin-up postcard girls and the first of the glamorous leading ladies I ever had the pleasure to see, and I have seen a large number. I'm sorry to have to say this, but I speak as I find English women used not to dress well. They were always adding bits and pieces to the original design. It was almost as if they were colourblind and thought that saffron, cerise, green and crimson all looked nice together. American women seem to have much more know-how, and of course, a French woman could make a smart hat out of a piece of linoleum. Today, youth have revolutionised clothes for the young, and they can be very attractive. Just look at some of my dear lady friends here tonight. Dorothy Perkins must be picked clean. In 1911, when I was 18, my mother succeeded in getting me an introduction to Charles Elias, the famous theatrical costumier in Soho Square, London, just on the strength of some of my dress designs. I became an assistant costume designer at £1 a week. Charles Elias was responsible for all the costumes in the magnificent pantomimes of Drury Lane, Edinburgh, Glasgow and Bristol, as well as the elaborate ballets at the Alhambra Theatre, Leicester Square. I remember some enormous headdresses of large tobacco flowers and leaves made in steel wire. They could be packed flat, and even if an elephant sat on it, it would have sprung back into shape. Of course, an elephant never did sit on one. That would have been quite surreal in Soho Square. The hats were covered with satin, dyed, and sequins and jewels were sewn on by the gals downstairs. Some of those elaborate pantomime costumes cost up to £20 each, but they were so well made they lasted for years. In fact, there's probably a drag queen in Blackpool slipping into one as I speak. As we made all the costumes for the Alhambra Ballet, I had a lot of free tickets given to me. The decor inside was oriental, and the programme always spectacular. The Alhambra was notorious for its promenades. which were nightly filled with the best-looking tarts in London and elegant femme du monde from the continent. One of these courtesans was often there in nothing but a hat, shoes, stockings, and a sable coat, which she would open tantalizingly as she walked slowly past the gentleman in full evening dress. Talk about a nod and a wink. In the dress circle, these women charged 10 guineas, and in the gallery, 3. But it wasn't long before the management banned readmission, so a quick one in a flat nearby, then back on the game in time for the second half, was stopped. Very cruel decision. Obviously, these ladies had little professional interest in a hard-up 17-year-old youth like me, but I did get to know one in particular, with whom I happened to be watching one of the ballets, and I said, "Isn't the finale of this one splendid?" Well, she looked at me in amazement. "Blimey, I've never seen the finale," she said. "If I didn't get off before that, I should think something had happened." As you can imagine, I daren't ever mention where I'd been when I got home. Despite the endless amateur theatricals and charades parties of the middle classes, professional entertainers were not accepted in Victorian society. So when I told my mother I wanted to be an actor, she replied stiffly, "I hope, dear, you will never come to that." But of course I did. And it turned out all right, as I shall reveal next time. Well, I think it's all gone terribly well, Martin. Let's get out of here, shall we, before they turn hostile. I'm a naughty Victorian lady, full of fire and desire. I live amidst antimacassars, hassocks, and pictures of generals about to expire. I fear it's an era much queerer than any since primitive races. So full of depressions, repressions, and stuffed birds in cases. But although I look pure and demure, don't imagine I'm slow. Oh no, oh no. I will have me fling, and I've learned everything that a lady should know. Naughty Victorian lady, so indiscreet. I don't think I'm dated because I'm created through memories, bitter and sweet. My mother's advice I'm continually scorning. I romp in the woods until 5 in the morning, and I play with the gypsies in spite of her warning. Oh, those naughty Victorian dames!